Hello, everyone. It's Dudley and Dimitri. I think it could be the Dudley and Dimitri show. Hello, everyone. Dimitri, you want to say hello to everyone quickly?
Hi, how are you doing, guys?
We got quite an exciting lineup today. We're getting into some of the meatier things today. So hopefully we can cover some myths and risks and things that people are worried about, but also some of the exciting things that are lying ahead. So I'm looking forward to the conversation.
So we will try to cover some technical stuff, and then we closer to the end of our conversation, we will see where specifically, especially generative artificial intelligence is used in the healthcare. Probably we'll provide several news, several examples. We'll show how other people are saving on generative AI, how they increase revenue. We'll bring a couple specific examples. So hopefully it should be useful for everybody today.
Yeah, and there are things that you don't know until you know, and I think as you get into new territory, sometimes things that didn't seem at all possible, you actually realize that, and there's a lot of hype as well, but you also actually realize that things are becoming more and more possible and quicker. The pace of things is definitely increased.
Well, the pace is actually mind-blowing. Let me put it this way. So I actually didn't realize until recently what's the pace, and I found a way to measure it, and it's actually a very interesting measurement tool. So the Hugging Face website, it's basically a repository of models, of data sets, of everything related to the artificial intelligence. And just for the last 2 months, there were more than 200,000 new open source models. So if you think about it, it's more than four models every minute added to this repository. Every minute. So and I don't see it slowing down. It's actually keep growing as crazy. So and I mean, it's pretty much everything. Every model you can think of: image processing, language to text to language to image to language. Fintech, everything. You just name it and you will find there. I mean, it's kind of mess right now. I mean, obviously there are a lot of garbage right now over there, but there are some diamonds that you need to actually dig up and use it in your applications.
Yeah, I think maybe this is a good place to start the conversation in just trying to define what do you mean by model? What do we mean by proprietary versus open source? Because I think that's a critical differentiator, and I think let's tackle that, because proprietary versus open source has been quite a big thing since the advent of computers in the early days. I mean, initially we had all kinds of operating systems, and you had the old DOS-based programs that came up as an operating system, and then it became Windows, and then sort of Windows and Microsoft took over from an operating system point of view. And then you also had the Mac operating system. So if you think about that as core operating systems, it's almost like, for me, it's having almost a duplicate of where things are going. So let's talk about proprietary versus open source.
That's actually a good example that you brought. And I mean, yes, we will discuss proprietary and open source, but right now it's actually slightly other way around, and I explain you why it's a slightly other way around. So proprietary models, proprietary models, that's something basically is licensed, that is owned by some private, publicly traded, doesn't matter, but private company, and it's a closed infrastructure. We don't know what's inside. We don't know how it's implemented. We have some knowledge if the company is happy to share some information about metrics, I don't know, number of tokens, number of parameters in the models, and so on, so on. But again, it's a very close and not available to the public, all details related to the proprietary. And it's licensed, more importantly. Open source, it's a very similar to the open source for the source code. So it's open source for LLMs. They available to the public. People can add value to those open source models. They can be reused even for the commercial use, and actually we'll come back a little bit literally in 1 minute about this. So they are not restricted. You can change it. You can retrain it. You can pre-train it. You can fine-tune it, and so on yourself, right? It's all available. The main difference with the example that you provided with operating systems is that big corporation companies such as Facebook, OpenAI, Microsoft, Google, they actually realized that keeping it close will not bring benefit to the industry, because to develop some decent model, you need a lot of resources, a lot of computing power. And even big universities sometimes do not have sufficient resources to buy this number of GPU to train some decent model. And they actually opened their proprietary models to the public. Not latest and greatest, just to be fairer, but we're talking about Llama, we're talking about GPT 3.5, we're talking about T5. So they are, they were released by those big players, and they became open source right now, which you can use for commercial purposes as well. There are limitations, obviously. I mean, they don't want big players to reuse those models. There are limitations about what the revenue for this commercial implementation, but for the 90% of the companies, that would be more than sufficient, and they will be within the threshold. So that's actually an attempt to provide more velocity to this industry and be more open, okay? And most of those models, by the way, on the Hugging Face, they are based either on Llama or T5. That's actually two major base models that are used for development, for specific fine-tuning, and so on, that are available for the public and open sources. Just to quickly go through the benefits, I guess, and disadvantages between...
Before you do that, I just want to, just for those of you that don't know, and this is... If you don't know what Hugging Face, if you go and look at the emojis and you see the emoji with the face and the hands sitting like this, that's a Hugging Face emoji. In fact, Hugging Face is the platform where a lot of the open source models are being kept. So a lot of people in this specific space know about Hugging Face. People outside this, let's call it this zone, don't know there's such a thing called Hugging Face. And in fact, that's only something I recently learned myself. So, and if you're not within the sort of this model and this development community, you actually don't know about Hugging Face. I mean, all you hear about commercially, or in, let's say from a hype point of view, is ChatGPT and Bard, now Gemini, and you have all these brand names and now Copilot with Microsoft, etc. But Hugging Face is not one of those sort of things that are being hyped about. The people in the know, the people that do programming, people that actually understand how to call on those language models, and we must just actually define the large language model as well, just for those that just not sure, because there's you have the large language model, then you got the fine tuning of it, and you also got the training of it. And there are a few elements there maybe we should just tackle before we go into too much more depth. But Hugging Face, just remember that emoji if you have no idea what this is.
Right. So getting back to the benefits of proprietary and open source. So with the proprietary models, well, they obviously are more powerful. They're using latest architectural solutions that were proprietary to whoever owns it. But at the same time, they do not have... Well, I mean, you probably all remember this big failure of the Gemini 1.5. We witnessed it last week with not quite appropriate generations and the apologies that Google made, and actually valuation drop in the Google price after this failure. So there are obviously risks about this. But with the open source, you know what you're getting. You know what is the training data is used for the training model. So it's not something obscured or safeguarded or some biased information. And if it's a biased, then you know how is it biased, Okay, you know very well what is the underlying architecture for this model. So you know its capabilities, you know its restrictions, you know how to handle it, and you know many other aspects related to the model. Also, open source models, they are available for the fine tuning, and we will get to this without too many details, but I'll explain for specific purposes, I guess, on some data set that you want to use. And what it means that you can actually take Llama model, which is a generically trained, and then make sure that it actually properly answers and properly works in the very narrow but focused. So I mean, narrow is a negative word, but focused is a positive word, I guess, theme. Focused way on specific topics, because the wider model is trained, the more vague, more hallucination comes from the model, and many other risks and negative, I guess, sides of the models are coming to the surface. But if you fine-tuning for your specific purposes, you reducing the risk, you make it more predictable, you make it more, basically more efficient for your specific purpose. And that's actually the only way how to build. And I'm not sure if, well, I mean, in previous our conversation, we did cover it, but even OpenAI with its latest GPT chat 4, they have eight different models inside. So they fine-tuned its huge system into the eight models, and each of these eight models is focused on specific domain. So, and it's actually this approach, architectural approach, everybody started to use with some quirks and interlocking communication between those models. But even inside of those proprietary models, this approach is implemented. So it's not something unusual and not something unheard about. Okay. What else should we talk about proprietary and...
Well, for me, if I think about there's one element about the training aspect, and that's happening internally in the proprietary environments as well. And that's I've signed up for the Gemini version to play around with it as well. And what's very, very interesting is there's an aspect, and I think they call it, if I remember correctly, it's called reinforced learning human feedback. So it's RLHF. Mm-hmm. What they do is they have humans that are part of the process of refining and checking that the answers are correct and that the system is not hallucinating. So part of open source means that when you build your own model, you double checking because you're very focused in terms of what the output is that you're trying to generate. A lot of those other models like Gemini, which is more, the only way to access a lot of those, especially the earlier versions of GPT, for instance, is you can have access to it, but you have to pull it into your own model, but you've got access to the large language model, but you can pull it in, and you know exactly what output you want. But when you got the general public, let's say the average user out there that's trying to write an email or trying to do something like just a question on maybe a search of some sort, when they ask Gemini or Bard or ChatGPT, they're expecting an answer that's near 100%. And what these proprietary systems are trying to do is to involve humans in double checking that to make sure that there's an extra layer of protection that it's not hallucinating in that regard. And GPT-4 is actually quite a lot more accurate than the earlier versions of GPT. And I saw one example where they said, like, so what's the name of Tom Cruise's mother? And the OpenAI, I think it was at that stage, gave the answer, I think it was Mary somebody. And then if they ask who's Mary, I can't remember the surname, who's her son, then the OpenAI couldn't answer the question, because it was looking at the data from two different, let's say, points of view. So Tom Cruise being well known and his mother being sort of a subset, if you ask the question the other way around, it actually doesn't know. So I think that's all part of the training and that human aspect. But maybe when we get into some more practical side, especially in the healthcare and life sciences environment, we can talk about how we can use some of these things in a practical way. But I thought that's just a very interesting part of what's busy happening with proprietary versus open source. Open source is becoming very use case specific, where proprietary for me is still quite open and more general public focus, if that makes
it, that, that's my assessment. And that it makes perfect sense. And actually, Dudley, I want to add another example. I mean, before we jump to to describing the risk of the open models and actually specific applications, the Gemini 1.5 is actually very good. I mean, besides the wrong safeguards that they have implemented, just to give you an example and understanding what its capabilities. So what they did in the test, they took a book from 19th century, well, describing basically 19th century story, regular novel, I don't know, 300-400 pages. And just in one sentence where they describe communication between two persons, they insert iPhone call. So this person made a call over the iPhone, something along this line, right? And Gemini was asked, find some inconsistency in this book. So it actually did find this specific.
So it's
literally needle in the hay approach. And just to compare, I'm pretty sure ChatGPT will not be able to find this kind of information because it's a way too generic. And Gemini was actually built specifically to find those one needle in the hay cases and very successful.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yes, it is amazing. And I mean, just to give you again capabilities, it's not just one book. I mean, Gemini with the pro version, once it's released and updated and available to the public, it can actually take about 10 million token. Token is basically relation to the number of words you can send to analyze and to generate it back. So you can literally send entire Harry Potter series, old books, well, besides maybe half of the last one, it just doesn't get this one 10 million token. And it will find this one small, single inconsistency in the book. Well, there are some other inconsistencies, I bet, but it's obviously one of the most obvious. I mean, it shouldn't be there. Okay.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah. That's true.
Yeah, so let's talk about then some of the risks, because I've also heard that hackers in that are getting involved and they're injecting code and even coding images and things and it's getting quite interesting that space. But let's talk about the number of or different types of risks that you know of.
Okay, so I mean you probably all heard such thing as hallucinations, as basically deviations from what you would expect to hear in the answer from all those LLM models. And well, obviously there are different ways of training and fine tuning of the models. And actually there are three different approaches, and they can be done either just one or consequently. I mean, they add value to each other. But the reason of such hallucinations usually comes from, it's either some data which was not properly fed to the model, or it was some kind of conflicts between input parameters. So one input says one thing and another input actually provides another answer, and that confuses the model. Or if it's incomplete information, then it's actually model start to fill those gaps by itself. And obviously, when it fills with something, it more likely will be incorrect because, I mean, it still doesn't think. It literally just summarizes the data. That's actually all it does in both of the cases, okay? Another thing, it's a bias, and that's actually one of the reasons why we had all this big story with Gemini 1.5 and actually fighting those biases. That's actually one of the reasons why LLM, especially like Llama, ChatGPT, T5, Gemini, pretty much any model right now, they have bias because
they are trained on the information which is basically comes from Western world. We're talking about, I don't know, well, I mean, besides the books, besides the libraries, and most of the cases, it's English-based books and libraries, which can cover some international information, obviously. But we're talking about Facebook, we're talking about Reddit, we're talking about LinkedIn. And in the most cases, because of the how information were fed, originally collected, especially for ChatGPT or for GPT, for OpenAI, and for Gemini, is a Western world bias. I'm not saying it from the bad, negative standpoint, but it just where the data came from. And obviously companies trying to fix this bias, sometimes unsuccessfully. And I think that's going to be a pretty big fight over the next many months or many years until our models become neutral in all aspects of this world. And
bias, if I can interrupt you quickly, I think the more you get to know in this world, the more you realize how little you know. and I remember studying law, and the professor the first day came onto the podium there, and I mean there was a big room of us young students. And the first words that came out of the professor's mouth on the law professor was, "There's a law for everything, but there's always an exception to the law." So there's always an opinion, and what is regarded as neutral. And I suppose that will be the big debate that's going to carry on for a very, very long time. And if I just think, was it yesterday in France they voted to enshrine the abortion, for instance, in their constitution. But in the US, for instance, a lot of the states now have banned abortion. You know, it's now not allowed. And so now who is right? And I'm not going to express any opinion on it, but I'm just saying it's amazing from government to government, and even sub-governments, if you look at the states, all govern themselves to a certain extent. It's amazing. So now who is right? And how do you determine? I mean, bias is in the eye of the beholder, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, well, true. And that's actually, you probably know this famous expression about like law enforcement. They enforce the law. They do not enforce fairness, right? I mean, the law should reflect the fairness. So that's by definition, you already have a bias. Just if you enforce the law, because it doesn't matter what's fair. There is a law and you must enforce the law. I mean, yeah, change the law and make sure that.
So it's going to be an interesting one going forward. So you got hallucinations. You obviously got the bias. Do you know of any other things that are risk factors that have to be taken into account?
Well, I mean, I think people are worried about hallucination bias, but in most cases, they are more worried about security. I mean, we're talking about leaking some information. We're talking about risks associated with leaking information. And that's actually, especially in a healthcare area, we know very well the last week event when Change Healthcare was hacked. We still don't know specific information yet about this, and that's actually a big concern. And it's not AI, it's actually, we're talking about established company with established infrastructure, with a standard, I bet, because I mean they have ISO certification, SOC 2 certification, with the established security protocols and everything else, and they still had this problem, which actually has a very big impact on the entire healthcare industry. So, and it's still not resolved, it's still pending, the situation. So, and I mean, it shouldn't be taken easily. It always should be taken very seriously and analyzed from all kind of aspects. And using AI needs to be very careful, following best practices. And actually, there are already established all kind of best practices. There are already some compliance that are in place, recommendations that are in place. and just need to follow those recommendations, just need to follow those best practices just to mitigate the risks that are associated with any technology, including artificial intelligence.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the only technology that's exposed. I mean, AI is just another technology. It's made up of code. It's made up of access to different data points. And there's obviously a user element. There are people that are making use of either input or output of data. So there's always the human aspect to it as well. I picked up that what some of the people are doing, and these are obviously not the people looking to steal data, is they inject code or they what they call jailbreak, I think they call it. You'll have to explain a bit about that. But they add additional code to the prompt, and it literally unlocks something that would normally be restricted. So, for instance, how to make a bomb or how to make something dangerous, you know, or how to, you know, end mankind or whatever it is, when normally there would be a restriction, but all you have to do is add on a little bit of extra prompt, and it can be just gibberish, rubbish, but it just unlocks the answer. So talk a little bit around that in some of these hacks that are now coming to the surface.
So, Dudley, well, first of all, I don't consider myself expert in this area specifically, right? I mean, we have people in our company who take care about this. And I mean, another, I guess, reason why I would prefer not to talk about this is because I don't want to give any ideas to the people who would use it. I know that it's you can search fine, but definitely I don't want to be a source of the additional information.
Yes, you want to be a source.
Yes, right. Guys, I can recommend how to protect it. I can recommend how to put an umbrella, security umbrella, and solutions. But no, I'm not a person that would give some ideas or inspirations to people.
Because I'm sure you can, and you're being very modest and humble about it. But I think that people should be aware that stuff is out there, and it is part of those protocols you were talking about. And it is something that must be taken seriously. But I think one thing that you did mention now is there's a specialist team that do it. It's not something you just do because you can. It's something that you do because you know what you're doing. So, and I suppose that's the message, is make sure you have the right people either on your team or from an outsourced point of view, that you bring the right specialists in place to safeguard your data, your company. Because at the end of the day, your systems are actually your business or the company or the organization. The systems fall over, the organization could stop functioning.
And I mean, the only thing I would add to this topic about especially security risks associated, that, as you said, every technology has risk associated with the security, but with majority of the technologies, we know how to handle. There are solutions in place, yes, I mean, they could be breached, I mean, something could be found, something was applied or something was implemented, so on, so on. But it's a very well-known, very well-defined industry and knowledge base, and yes, something new comes, but it's a stable area. With artificial intelligence, it's an area where we, in many cases, we don't know what we don't know, and a lot of people, very creative people, are actually either using it or showing it, and you just need to be extra careful with any security risks, especially related with artificial intelligence, and you need to understand what you're doing. And I guess self-educating here is not the best approach. Find an expert who would actually cover your back in this area.
Well said. So tell us a little bit more. I mean, if I look at our notes here, we've got non-diagnostic LLM, we've got billing claims, etc. So there are certain trending items out there at the moment in terms of, especially if we look in the healthcare and life sciences. Let's talk a bit around where the applications actually sit. I mean, let's talk practical things now.
Well, I mean, you know that the market, this invisible hand of the market, right, free market, it makes decision.
And from what we are seeing right now in the over the past several months, there are some low-hanging fruits, I guess, hanging in the market, and capital and companies are actually using this opportunity. And there are two biggest trends we see in the investment and in the implementation. It's either non-diagnostic large language models, that's you're talking about claim, reading, PHI, integrations, conversation analysis, billing, or it's actually some decision-making LLMs, obviously based on the generative LLM models, which do assist basically diagnostic, assist in some decision-making, triages, and so on and so on. So that's basically, as I said, two major domains where generative AI is being used. That's obviously not the only areas. There are many other areas, and we will go through this. And what we will do, I guess we will try to reflect those solutions through the prism of cost saving and see how exactly expenses can be reduced in those approaches using those solutions. Well, I guess there are three major categories. It's enhanced patient experience, clinical decision support, and administrative efficiency. So let's start with the first one, enhanced patient experience. Well, obviously chatbots, something similar to ChatGPT, very well known to everybody. That is easiest, I guess, from the implementation standpoint and most impactful from the communication with the patient's tool. Yeah. So it can talk to the patients. It doesn't have to leave the call center at 5 p.m. It can work 24/7. It can actually take some tasks on top of this, such as, I don't know, scheduling an appointment, providing some, reading some basic information, collecting data from the patients before patient comes to the doctor, so you wouldn't spend time, and actually nurses wouldn't spend time with you collecting additional information. Then another one is personalized health education. That's actually getting bigger and bigger, at least from what we see from our standpoint. That is where generative AI can be used to generate educational material, which is specific for the patient case, for the patient needs. And it actually can talk in the generalized, I guess, the treatment or this treatment plan in the normal language that patients can actually understand. And if they don't understand something, they can actually clarify and make sure that patients understand every single detail from those educational material. And another actually very specific area, it's mental health support. And that's actually very interesting, because we receive two contradictive messages about mental health support. From one side, we are told that patients don't want to talk to chatbots because they need more humanish support, especially in some specific areas. I probably wouldn't touch those, kind of naming those areas, because of some sensitivity, I guess, political especially. But from another standpoint, they think, well, some people don't want to talk about some aspects, personal aspects with human people. And they, if they know and if they trust that this chatbot actually is isolated, information doesn't go anywhere and just can answer the question, they prefer to talk to those chatbots because they know that no human being will know about this conversation. So it's almost like talking to the priest, to be frank. So as I said, two absolutely contradictive messages, but I mean, from our standpoint, well, I mean, we can implement it one way or another way. It doesn't really matter from the technical standpoint, but just to know.
I suppose what it does to a certain extent is it gives people the choice.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably where we're seeing, and I heard somebody call it, don't call it artificial, it's actually augmented intelligence. It's adding to, and I think we touched on that in our last conversation. It's not necessarily taking what's currently happening and just turning it into an artificial form. It's adding additional layers of things that have not previously been possible. We never had a choice in the past. If you had a mental health issue and you didn't have anything else. You couldn't go and talk to the wall or talk to, I don't know, your pet dog or whatever. You tried maybe, but it didn't really work. Now you can have a conversation, and you can have an intelligent conversation and a useful conversation with.
I mean, intelligence probably you kind of too far, but useful conversation helps you to understand
the perception of intelligence. In other words, it's not just a dumb bot that sort of, you know, just gives you random answers, but it does. And I picked up there is a product called Her or something like that, where you can actually have a human like conversation with an AI, some kind of, I don't know, voice like a telephone that you, someone you can talk to, and it's like really, really human. So, I suppose the point I'm trying to make here is that people can have the choice, and whether you want this or that, you can have one of each, and you don't have to have a choice of it's this or that. It could be, you know, it's not this only or that only. It's, you know, it's, you got a choice between the two.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And nothing can be added to this.
Nothing can be added to that. So, okay. So mental health support, I like that. But then there's also, for me, what happens often is when people are in, especially when you're dealing with people that are emotional, let's say, for instance. I mean, it's also, if you think about somebody, the family, let's say there's been a motor car accident, collision, whatever it is, and you have a number of people that have been injured, and you have people that have been taken to a particular place, they're being treated, but the family don't know. So you could also have things like family support and other things that will reduce the load from the people that need to be attending to the patient. So you could have additional layers that you can build in that'll be supportive, not just to patients, but to you know, to the extended family and friends, etc., around the patients. Obviously, there's privacy and that sort of thing as well, but then at least you can then put some parameters in place to support.
Yep, and that's true. And remember, like at the beginning of this categorization, I promised to give it from the to give information from the cost saving standpoint, just to give you a couple numbers and just to show how significant it is. So basically, like Cleveland Clinic in Nagoya, they release a research result that basically says that AI-powered chatbots can reduce call center cost by 30 to 50%. And that's,
wow.
Yes. So that's, it's not 5% improvement. It's not 6% improvement. It's like, hey guys, somewhere around 30 and 50%. I mean, and there is a more.
That's almost half.
Yes. And so it's like, wow. Yes. And again, don't forget, it's a 24/7 and it doesn't get tired. It doesn't get tired to answer the same questions over and over and over again. It doesn't raise a voice. It doesn't think about, I don't know, his kids, his parents, his other problems.
It doesn't have feelings.
It doesn't have feelings. That's true.
There's another part of that whole call center thing. And this, I suppose this goes into where AI overall is looking to help a lot of those repetitive tasks. AI can support that. But for me is when you got new employees, if you look at those call centers, they would be hiring people all the time. You have people that would spend their time, you know, for a number of years, though they probably won't be a massive career choice for their entire 40-year career. They might be there for 3 or 4 or 5 years as part of their personal growth. So you're going to constantly have new people coming in, and you're going to have people leaving. So people leaving often have got all the knowledge, and the new people come in, they need to be trained and supported. Yep. to then make sure that they get up to a certain level. With AI, I think your onboarding costs of new people, and then also your exit, you don't lose the that all the knowledge doesn't just disappear out of the organization too.
It's actually being accumulated, because as you verify and check those conversations between chatbots or whatever system you have, you're actually making adjustments to the prompts. You make an adjustment, maybe another system that you are developing, which are more fine-tuned, and so on. So that's actually not flowing knowledge, it's accumulated knowledge, which is another benefit. Oh, by the way, I mean, well, we actually running out of time. Another thing which we are discussing here, saying, well, guys, you can reduce call center cost by 30-50%. Obviously, I mean, most of the people interpreting it in this way. Wow, it's going to be 30-50% of the people in those call centers to be on the street. And I guess the simple answer is yes, but, and I'm trying to educate everybody on more complex answer. This is an inevitable result of the technical development. And that's actually, there was a very interesting case which I learned recently. You probably remember, like on the Wall Street, there was a trading floor. People were screaming, showing on the fingers, trading. Like,
I remember that.
Yes, yes. And then computers came, and few people realized that computers is actually what going to replace all this trading floor. And the thing is, people who actually realized it and went into this direction, unless they were too old, they kept working after this trading floor was closed. And everybody else who didn't want, who postponed it and stayed on this trading floor until last moment, they just couldn't find themselves because, I mean, obviously optimization, more efficient, higher scale of trading with a computer, just and the industry didn't need so many traders anymore. So it's inevitable. It's better, but I guess some recommendation to the people, you need to keep learning. You need to get into the new generation of the industry. You need to know how to manage this artificial intelligence and how to work with this artificial intelligence. And that's, I guess, my only recommendation in this area to everybody who think they will be affected by this revolution.
Yeah, and I think it's also partly the employer, the management, the senior management, the owners and shareholders and stakeholders of those organizations to be thinking about starting to map out what does a future look like for those people that could potentially be replaced by this kind of technology. It's nothing new, really, if you think about going from the old farming communities that used to be subsistence farming, and then it became more, you know, more little towns and things. And then that meant some people would do office work and other people would work on the farms. And then it became this big industrial revolution where almost everybody wanted to live in the city and work in a factory. And there was hardly anybody left on the farms to work to make food for people to eat. Now there's commercial farming and the system just seems to adapt and people seem to adapt. And I think if you, as long as you're not keeping yourself blind to the changes and you keep yourself up to speed.
That's true. So let's quickly go through other aspect where generative AI can be used. I mean, obviously it can be used in the, as I said, in clinical decision support. So we're talking about some risk assessment where generative AI can actually generalize information and provide some inconsistencies for the patients, especially if it's some specific disease which was overlooked by the doctor. And I mean, we're talking again, remember example, needle in the hay. So that's actually very useful here. So it will find this needle in the hay and will point on something that are relevant. Drug discovery and development, that's basically, I guess, it's a source for inspiration. It's a source of new ideas. It's a source of generalizing some known information. I mean, while generalizing information, I mean, you probably know that. Everybody know that. Everybody played. Generative AI can generate pictures, can generate movies, can generate even script for the movies. The quality is maybe not ideal, but I mean, the industry is growing. It's going to be ideal very soon. But my point is, while it seems like it is creative, it's not actually creative. It's just generating ideas based on the information it has and providing this idea and providing this output. So with the drug discoveries, it's actually, I guess, one of the benefits. It just shows you something that was overlooked by humans and provides you additional information. So it's very useful.
If you think about even like antibiotics and those types of things that were, had to be discovered by somebody and had to be trialed and so on, you could have a lot of that being advanced a lot quicker,
yeah,
as opposed to somebody just happening to fall over some even a mistake, if you like. Yeah, so I mean that would be quite useful, I think.
Yeah. And another big area is actually administrative efficiency, and that we're talking about report generating. I don't know, like for example, summarizing medical records. Again, I guess I will go to which company actually made this study. Oh, Novina, they made the study, and according to their studies, that just AI assistant that could summarize the medical records can save for physicians 48 minutes per day. I mean, it's not 30-50% as with the call centers, but 48 minutes a day for physician. That's basically, yeah, that's basically another 2 or 3 or 5 people, depending on the physician's approach, per day for physician. So, well, I mean, here it's not cost saving, I guess. Here it's a revenue increase and a more efficient way to handle patients.
Yeah, I think also if I think of the having to do a report or write up notes after having a conversation with somebody, yeah, it takes a lot of mental energy and it takes a lot of brain power and time, and I would say I think dopamine is the thing that, but you feel drained after having to do all that additional work. So that'll even free up their mental capacity to be better in terms of caring for patients and finding problems and addressing the issues that they get thrown at.
The only thing I guess I can raise a red flag here, if you fully rely on the AI or any tool that would think for you from the summarizing notes, creating reports and everything else, that's actually can reduce doctor's involvement, mental involvement, because when you summarize, you actually think it through. As you think it through, you actually find your mistakes, you actually find your what you missed during the questionnaire or something else came up in your mind. But again, all those nuances can be handled, already can be handled by generative AI. So it just needs to be open, I guess, to the ideas and make sure that all the disadvantages that come with AI can be actually turn it into the advantage. So that's actually goes, I guess, just the enhancing patient experience from the previous.
Yeah, time. Yeah, and the effectiveness of the healthcare professionals, etc. We've got a few minutes left, and I want to leave a cliffhanger. So next episode, I think we need to be covering a lot of the myths and misconceptions on our next episode, because they're flying about, and one of them is that people are just going to lose their jobs and nobody going to work, etc. But let's leave it for the next episode. But what I maybe just want to just go through a process where I think if people want to now start looking at, let's say they want to start introducing AI into their organizations, what's sort of the process? Let's say they come to you and they say, okay, you know what, Dimitri, help. We want to get this in here. We see there's lots of savings. We see we can increase our revenues. We can do this and that. Where do we start? What's the starting point?
Well, that's actually, there are two starting points. You can either start from the beginning or you can start from the end. So I guess let's start from the beginning. I mean, from the beginning, I guess it's a kind of cheating to some extent. But, well, not wrong, I guess, choice of word. So you're looking at what kind of capabilities in this industry right now? Chatbots. Oh, there are chatbots. I would like to use a chatbot in my application. And the expert will say, yeah, it's appropriate for your application to have a chatbot. I mean, the limitations, technical solutions, time frame, and so on, so on. I heard that as we went like today through the, I heard about risk assessment or drug discovery or medical image analysis. So that's actually somehow relevant to my application. I would like to take a look. And then that's actually from the beginning. And we start discovering how specifically it can be used. Is it useful? Is it actually will bring a value to the product, increase their revenue or reduce their cost, or actually both? Sometimes that happens as well. And if you start from the end, then you actually start looking at the system from the big standpoint and start looking at the all kind of workflows, all kind of functionality, and you start looking on which workflows are repetitive, which workflows people are involved too much and can introduce all kind of issues, mistakes, human factors, and so on, so on. What are the bottlenecks in the application that doesn't allow the application to be more scalable in the specific implementation? So we're looking at all those aspects and we start looking at, is it possible to solve? And in many cases, the solutions are not available at the market right now. So that's actually a more efficient way to look at the solutions, because you look at the problem, you think how exactly this problem can be solved, and then you start solving this problem either with a new model, you train it, or you start looking for a new model. Or sometimes actually works quite well, especially in this highly dynamic industry, as we mentioned at the beginning of this conversation. You start implementing this model, you start architectural solutions, and then in 2, 3, 4 months, as everything is in place from the technical standpoint, you start looking for the models, open source models or available models. And in many cases, actually, available after 3 or 4 months. It wasn't available back then, but now it's available. Yeah. Now. You can use it. So that works out very well, by the way. I mean, nothing wrong about this. Yes, you take risks about this, but it's a calculated risk and a risk can be mitigated. You have plan B, then it doesn't happen, then you take Llama. You just need to fine-tune this Llama model for your specific purposes and you will be fine as well. But you can actually cut a corner here as well. So that's,
I suppose it's your preference, and I suppose it's a lot to do with the use case. Look, everyone's using that particular, let's say, chatbots. It's a proven thing. It's plug and play. It's a product. You pay a fee or whatever it is, and it's in. It's done. It's tested. It's used by other companies. It's easy peasy. The other way is, there's a use case, but there's no product that exists currently. And so you might think, you know what, this is a really important area we need to address in the organization. Let's address it, but let's address it. Let's create the use case. I think what people try to do is they create the use case, then you create a business case, like what is the return on investment? Because you also have to think about the costs and that. And then once you've got that, then I think the third step is sometimes you do a sandbox environment where you create a small test case. So you get a number of users just to run through, or a number of instances where you could put your use case to test.
Yeah.
And then if that's ready, then you can roll it out into whatever the rest of the organization or the rest of that workflow. So there's definitely different ways to deal with this. And there could be a product, or maybe the product's available in 3 months. Or it could be what I expect would be, especially in more complex environments, the product market fit won't always be 100%, because sometimes the products are developed for specific use cases which may not exactly fit a different organization or an organization similar, but that have got different processes or different, you know, internal workings and so on. So fascinating conversation. I don't know if you want to have any last few words you want to share.
No, I mean, just to add a little bit to this approach that I and what you added. Obviously, each case is a very unique, and it's not about what is available in the industry or what the creative practice of building. A lot of restrictions, I guess, come from the budget standpoint, actually the end goal of the implementation. I mean, if it's a small startup, I mean, that's chatbot is the only thing we can afford. If it's some pharmaceutical company, obviously they have significantly more money to invest into the drug discovery and so on, so on. So approaches do depends on this one. And obviously time frame. I mean, I need a AI stamp on my website from the marketing standpoint, for the marketing purposes, and do something. Or I want to be on the edge of this industry. I want to lead this industry, and I want to have AI as a central piece of my solution. So that's I guess, other factors that affect how exactly you approach on the solution, on looking at the more appropriate solution for this case. So it's a very multidimensional thing, not just.
I think there's also a need to not just wait because I'm the what I guess, and from having done more and more research and study and seeing some of the practical applications, what I've realized is that AI is one of those accumulative knowledge building technologies. The longer you use it, the smarter it gets. The more you test and train, the smarter and the better the application becomes, and it starts doing self-teaching. And I think if you start too late and your competitors are already starting early, you could be behind the curve no matter how fast you try to go, because you don't have that accumulative learning effect that's happened if you can put in the system as soon as possible. So you got to also be wary of, I might not have the budget for it right now, or might not think I've got the budget, but the opportunity cost, the loss in time, and that accumulative knowledge building effect of AI, I think one mustn't underestimate. I think you mentioned right at the beginning, I'm going to come back, close the loop and say 200,000 more models were added to Hugging Face just in the last 2 months.
Yes.
And that's how rapidly this thing is growing. So I don't think we should underestimate the pace of change.
You actually nailed one of the painful issues, by the way. It's not with the generative AI, it's for predictive AI. In many cases, when company wants to implement predictive AI, they need data. And sometimes it's publicly available data, but in many cases, it's their proprietary data they want to use. And they say, well, we will start implementing something next year. That's good, guys. But next year, when you start implementing, you actually will need this data available already for the training purposes. Do you have it? No, you probably will use the current data. No, you cannot just use the current data. The current data needs to be properly structured so it could be actually useful for the training. So, I mean, that's, I guess, my recommendation for the companies that they think they can think about predictive AI in some near future. At least start looking how you gather proper data structure for your further future project. That's, I guess, we can...
That's a brilliant way to end today's episode. Thank you, Dimitri. So, guys, follow us. We're going to be doing this every single week. Subscribe, give us a like, and share with your friends, colleagues, and people that you know that may be interested in this type of thing. I just think you need to be armed. Whether you you're a decision maker or not, I think you need to be armed. Need to be ready for the change that's coming, and it's coming. It's probably already here. Although AI, in its true sense, started 50 years ago, the ramp up now is phenomenal. And I think even if you think you're not really going to be part of it, it's going to affect you. So definitely follow us, and we'll try and share as much useful information as possible.
Okay. See you next week, guys.
See you next week. Thank you.